Welcome to the 95th Interpreter Roundtable, where as we inch towards the 100th, which will probably be our first one of the old, actually probably our first one of the New Testament. Today we're on lesson number 45, Gospel Doctrine, Old Testament, If I Perish, I Perish, talking about some of the stories at the start of Daniel and Esther. With us we have Daniel Peterson, Ben McGuire, Mike Parker, and I'm Bruce Webster. Hope you enjoy this. This is we've decided this is going to be a free-for-all, so we'll see what comes out of this. The stories we're going to talk about today are the stories that we spend time reading to our children. Pick up any volume of Bible stories for children, LDS or not, and you're going to find stories from Daniel and the story of Esther in there as well. The problem we face is there's not a lot of historical background for these stories. The fact that some of the Daniel stories have internal chronology, which doesn't make sense. I'll defer to Mike to talk about that in a minute. Esther, there are some significant problems all through it in terms of it being historical. In fact, it actually, if you read it carefully, is almost more like a Shakespearean comedy than a volume of scripture. Complete with, you know, reversals, betrayals, and a happy ending. So with that, I'm going to punt over to Mike and let him start talking about some of the specific problems that we face with this. And again, mind you, you know, these are great stories, and we have stories like them that are much better documented and frankly more historical in the Book of Mormon. And I'm going to turn it over to Mike to say why we need to approach the stories in Daniel and Esther with caution.
Thanks, Bruce. I'm having technical difficulties as usual, so if I cut out, let me know, please. Daniel, like you said, is one of the most famous stories from the Old Testament. It's one of those ones that you begin with in primary or junior Sunday school, for those of us who are really old and remember that. you know, the story of Daniel in the lion's den and the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and being cast in the fiery furnace. These were very, very famous stories. The problem is that, well, why don't we start with, first of all, the book itself, the first six chapters, do not claim to be written by Daniel. They're all written anonymously in the third person. They're about Daniel and his three friends in that one chapter. There are some very weird chronological issues with it and some historical difficulties, as Bruce mentioned. Let me give you a couple of examples. Chapter 1, it starts right off with chapter 1, verse 1, where it says that Nebuchadnezzar, according to the book, captured Jerusalem in the third year of the reign of Joachim. Now, that would have been 606 BC, but unfortunately, Nebuchadnezzar didn't actually ascended the throne until 605, a year later, and didn't capture Jerusalem until 597. So the chronology is off. Chapter 5 talks about Belshazzar, mentions him as the king of Babylon, but Belshazzar never was the king of Babylon. He was the son of Nabonidus, who was the king of Babylon. And then when you get to the end of... I apologize. Yes, no, that's correct. Belshazzar. But then you get to the end of chapter 5, and it says that Darius the Mede has overthrown Babylon. Well, there was no historical person named Darius the Mede. There were some Persian kings named Darius, but we don't have any king of the Medes. And Babylon wasn't overthrown by the Medes. It was overthrown by the Persians, and the Persian king's name was Cyrus. So, you know, it's just kind of all over the place. And so what it seems to indicate here is that Daniel is not written during the time when it's supposed to be taking place. What it most likely is a collection of traditions, a collection of stories that were told probably orally, and then only much later committed to paper without the benefit of having historical records. Probably when it was committed to paper was in the second century BC, somewhere around 170 down to 165 BC, which would make Daniel the last of the Old Testament books. to be written, and there's a lot of history behind that and why most scholars think that that's the date for it. I think that's about all I want to talk about, at least up front. I'm just going to hand it off to, I think, Ben. Were you up next?
Yeah, I can add a couple comments to this. One of the interesting things, at least about Daniel, is this. In Jewish traditions, Daniel is considered part of the third category of scripture, the writings. So we have the books of Moses, we have a group called the prophets, and then we have the writings, you know, Proverbs, Psalms, perhaps inspired, but not on the same level in terms of authority. And to the Jews included, Daniel is part of the writings. And then for some of you who may remember this, Jesus talks about Daniel in Matthew 24, verse 15, which reads, "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place." And so we have Jesus referring to Daniel the prophet. And so in the first couple of centuries, we have a number of early Christian writers who worked very hard to convince the world that Daniel ought to be a part of the prophets. And so we see a lot of discussion, a lot of interpretation in the early church about this particular text. More than that, we have to understand, too, that when we talk about it being written during this Persian period that Mike talked about, it's an attempt to use stories about this older period, the Babylonian captivity, to help Jews during this Persian period, especially Jews that were not living in Palestine, to have a way to understand their own their community and how they're a part of it when they're not necessarily directly connected to it. And in a sense, we get this blending of a historical reality. These stories about Daniel don't come from this period when this is written, but they're written down and prepared in this period. So we have kind of this blending of a historical reality and their present reality, which creates these chronological issues, but isn't really aimed at giving us a history. It's really aimed at trying to teach the Jews how to relate to their religion and their faith and their community when they're surrounded by non-Jews and put into circumstances where it can become very difficult to live their religion in an appropriate way. Perhaps this is maybe history as it ought to have been, right, as opposed to history as the way it was.
Can I add something to that, Ben?
Yeah.
I would actually go further than that and say that these collections of stories don't even come from the Persian period, that they're actually from the Greek period. The Persians were fairly laissez-faire as far as allowing people to worship their own god and live their own religion. The Jews during the Persian period weren't really under a lot of pressure to conform. That only comes later when you get into the Greeks particularly when you get to Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who in the early second century is slaughtering pigs in the temple and making the Jewish religion illegal and so forth. So even if the stories come from earlier, they really become important to the Jews about that time. So you get things like chapter 1 answers the question of, do we eat foods that have been sacrificed to idols, or do we maintain those kosher food regulations? Or chapter 3 tells us what do we do if we're living in a foreign land and there are local gods there? Do we worship those gods or do we worship Jehovah? Or chapter 6, which is, you know, what do we do if the worship of Jehovah is banned altogether? Should we observe the law of the land or the law of God? And that actually does happen under Antiochus the Fourth. So even if the stories have their basis earlier, I really don't think that they become important or become what we would call scripture until much, much later, almost to the time that we see Jesus appearing. They're only 150, 100, or 200 years old by the time of Christ.
Dan, what have you
Well, I was just going to say one thing to go along with that, and that is that these are the same reasons why they became important to the Christians during their earlier persecutions under the Roman Empire.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand the function that the stories served. And so even if there is some historical core to the stories, they seem to have been committed to writing much later, during a period where the stories were really important to remind people of. You wanted to encourage Jews who were under pressure to live the law, to remain faithful even when it was difficult, because ultimately God will deliver you if you're faithful. Your enemies will be destroyed, they'll be smitten, and so on. It's the same motivation that you get. And of course, Daniel is partly an apocalyptic book, but it's an important theme in apocalyptic literature that no matter how bad it gets, if you're faithful, it will get better for you. Your side will win. And that's certainly the kind of idea that you get out of the Book of Esther, you know, that the Jews ultimately triumph. The Book of Daniel, if you're faithful, you'll do all right. It's your enemies who will pay, and you'll be respected for standing up for your beliefs and so on. So in that sense, it's not hard to see why Latter-day Saints would find the stories meaningful in some ways. When you're under pressure, when people are coming after you, when they're ridiculing you and so on, well, do as Daniel did. Do as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. Remain faithful, and in the end, you'll be all right. So they're powerful stories. And, you know, so I'm inclined to think, going back to the overall issue of historicity, there may be some core of truth to them. I don't want to come across as a thoroughgoing skeptic, but already one of the problems has been mentioned here, that that the Persian kings, for example, did not require worship. And yet that shows up in the Book of Daniel. So some of these things just don't seem to fit the historical scene. If there is historical truth there, it may have been somewhat distorted by years of oral transmission and souping the stories up, making them grander and better and so on. So then it's written down. Doesn't mean there isn't inspirational material there. It doesn't mean there aren't some true prophecies there and so on in a couple of cases. But they're just insuperable historical difficulties from my point of view.
And that actually gets back to a point I mentioned early on. Just in the course of my lifetime, and Dan, you may have noticed this as well, it's been interesting to see the shift, you know, talking about junior Sunday school and primary, to see the shift away from some of the Bible stories like that and a focus more on the parallel or relevant Book of Mormon stories.
Yeah.
Which, if you step back, actually are much better attested historically. You have, you know, compared to the Old Testament, Book of Mormon is you know, an exquisite work of history, just because of the controls and the documents and the number of the relatively few number of hands that touch this stuff. And it was interesting going through these stories, saying, you know, these are great, but these are not the stories I tend to hear anymore in talks. The stories I tend to hear are, you know, Nephite being obedient in spite of opposition, the stripling warriors, you know, Alma and Amulek being cast into prison, you know, there's a whole host of stories in the Book of Mormon that serve the same good and do so in a from a context where, you know, we don't have to worry about the historical thing. I mean, the core issue here is trying to avoid falling into sort of the role of inspiring fiction.
Yeah.
But, you know, the truth is that there are some real, you know, significant and possibly insuperable historical problems with these. And the best thing to do is say, and these are examples that are good to follow, but, you know, don't base your testimony of God on whether or not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were actually tossed into a fiery furnace or not.
Yeah. I mean, and you can still find inspiration in a play of Shakespeare or
A
great novel. Les Miserables was an inspiration to many people. Was there really a historical Jean Valjean? Well, the question's irrelevant. There wasn't, but it doesn't matter. You know, in that sense, I'm hoping this isn't casting the Interpreter Foundation in too liberal and radical a light. I've worried about this just a bit, but, you know, to be honest, I take a pretty high view of the historicity of the scriptures, but I have to admit that when I read Daniel and Esther, I think to myself, you know, these read like like popular ancient yarns.
Yeah. Well, it's the same issue we've covered in roundtables on Jonah, on the first half of the Book of Joshua, and a few other books where it's, you know, this is stuff that was deliberately structured, was not written by the prophet himself, and you know, has some significant historical problems to it, but, or for that matter, the Book of Job. It's a fine walk we have to take through the Old Testament, which again is one of my reasons for gratitude for the Book of Mormon and the provenance and evidences, internal, external, for the Book of Mormon. I have said before, actually, I told a friend who was teaching Old Testament, called to teach Old Testament, I said, just remember the Old Testament is the least correct book of Scripture. but I love it. I love it dearly.
Oh, yeah.
I love the stories. I love the histories. I love the people. There's tremendous truth in there. There's tremendous inspiration. But don't put yourself in a situation where you find yourself trying to defend the historicity of specific events or circumstances in the Old Testament that may not be supportable.
Well, you know, here, to put it in clear perspective, it seems to me, okay, if it were somehow provable that Jesus did not rise physically from the grave, that would have devastating implications for Christianity in mm-hmm. general and Mormonism in particular. If it could be somehow proven that Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego didn't spend time in a fiery furnace, I'm trying to think of any point of LDS theology that would be impacted in any way by that. And the fact is I can't think of one.
Yeah. And that's actually true of all these stories here.
Yeah.
That's a good touchstone there. Anyway, so...
Sorry, point out one more thing. Just one last thing is how Latter-day Saints approach the Book of Daniel. It's very interesting to me that there are certain pieces of the book that speak to us very... very profoundly, especially chapter 2, which is not part of this lesson tonight.
Yeah.
But what we're most familiar with as Latter-day Saints are those first six chapters, at least portions of the first six chapters, which are all part of that narrative. The part that Latter-day Saints are generally not familiar with, even remotely, out of all the scriptures, it's probably the most ignored passages of any scriptural text, are the last six chapters, chapters 7 through 12. There is a very strong tradition among certain Protestant Christians, evangelical Christians, who are very big into end times prophecy and trying to figure out, you know, what's all the numerology and, you know, what about all the strange animals with the multiple heads and all of that kind of thing and try to connect it with Ezekiel and especially with the Book of Revelation. And Latter-day Saints, we just simply ignore those chapters, with the exception of that little tiny, just the two or three verses in chapter 7 that talk about I drew a blank here. What are we talking about?
Chapter 7 of Daniel?
Come to help me out. Ancient of Days. Oh,
yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, sorry, Ancient of Days. Yeah,
the Son of Man with the Ancient of Days, yeah.
As I mean, Ancient Days, and we have a very unique interpretation that does not go along with anybody else's interpretation.
Right.
And we just simply ignore all of this stuff. So, and in fact, there isn't a gospel doctrine lesson that even touches chapter 7 through 12, as well as chapter 4. You'll notice it gets skipped in this lesson because it's kind of a weird story in chapter 4, so it's not part of... not part of the lesson material. We tend to shy away from things that are difficult to explain. So,
yeah.
Okay. Now that we've talked about all that, let's talk what we can do to give our gospel doctrine teachers a chance to make this meaningful to their students. Why don't we go ahead and go to Daniel chapter 1 and the story of Daniel and his three companions being tested. Well, I'll let someone else take it. Who'd like to start with Daniel 1? Dan, you want to read some? Mike, do you
well,
open your mouth? Dan, do you want
Mike,
to read
if you want to do it, go ahead.
Sure. Were we going to read it or just want to recap it and then talk about it?
Let's do a... It's actually a pretty long chapter, all things
considered. Yeah. I don't know if there's any particular passage that stands out. You have the account. I can recap it a little bit. That they've been told, they've been brought into the court. They're told that they can eat from the wine that the king drinks and eat from his food. And And they really don't want to. And, of course, the head of the eunuchs is saying, well, come on now, if you starve to death under my care, you're not only putting yourself in, yourselves in jeopardy, but me. I mean, I'm supposed to take care of you. And so Daniel responds, go ahead, you know, you'll give us a 10-day test, and we'll look fine, and then you'll be able to go ahead. Now, I know that that we are sometimes, we have sometimes in the past, I don't know if we still do, we sometimes use this as an example of how faithfulness to the word of wisdom can make you healthy. And Mike,
that's
I know
actually,
you
that's
don't
actually
think
that's the right doctrine manual.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, my. Oh, my. I should have looked.
That isn't what it's about, though. It doesn't have anything to do with wisdom. It has to do with something that we don't really have a strong connection with, and that's how do we deal with food that's ritually impure?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to do with the fact that the king's food, it wasn't fattening, it didn't have high cholesterol, it wasn't any of those kind of things. The fact was is that the king's food had been sacrificed to idols, and now it was being eaten by the public, and that was a very common thing in the ancient world, is that they would have a festival or a feast or whatever. You'd bring all this food, you would offer it to a god by laying it on the altar in front of him and so forth, and then when all the festivities are done, everybody would tuck in and finish off the food, and Daniel and his friends say, no, we're not going to do that. Now, that's not actually directly forbidden in the Law of Moses, but it does become an issue later on among the Jews, and so it becomes part of their tradition that we're not going to do that. It actually comes up again in the New Testament under Paul, when he's writing to the Corinthians. The Corinthians are doing the same thing with their Greek worship. Is it okay to eat food that's been sacrificed to Apollo or Aphrodite or so forth? And so Daniel and his three friends aren't avoiding it because it's bad for them. They're avoiding it because it's been offered to false idols and is ritually impure. I don't know how to connect that to Latter-day Saints today. We don't look at coffee or tea or tobacco as being ritually impure. We look at it as being as unhealthy and as part of the commandment, but
Let me jump in there too, because I've actually just one follow up on that. I had an encounter some years ago with a member of the church who felt that smoking was an inherent sin. In other words, it was a sin for a non member to smoke. And I said no. I said it's not a sin for them to smoke. They're under no commandment not to smoke. It's one of the reasons the Lord, when he first gave the word of wisdom, said, you know, had all his initial language, you know, to the weakest of those who can be called saints and so on. And of course, Thomas Alexander has a good history of just the whole how our current observance of the word of wisdom came to be. But that I think that's an important point to make is that, you know, if we are under covenants, particularly those of us who hold or seek to hold temple recommends, we're expected to live up to a certain standard. But again, the issue here is as you said, is ritual purity. It's not I'm better than you because I eat, you know, beans and water, as opposed to the king's delicacies.
Yeah, I suppose you could make the connection there that there is the commonality of a food prohibition or a dietary code, and we have one, they had one. Theirs was very differently motivated, but still, it was a dietary code, and they tried to keep it. And we have one, we try to keep it, though it's quite different in motivation and in form. I don't think that, I mean, it's possible we may discover at some point that the wine of the king was caffeinated. That might have been the whole, the whole problem.
Well, and beyond that, at that point there was, I believe, under the Law of Moses, there's no prohibition against wine. So this, you know, the abstinence from wine seems to be either a later elaboration by the Jews as going back to the later date under the Persians and Greeks of possible composition here, because otherwise there's no inherent reason for Daniel and his friends not to drink wine.
Right. Yeah, we sometimes try to read the word of wisdom back into the New Testament, so that is not a good road to go.
When I had New Testament from Kent Brown, had three classes from him, but he talked about being a graduate student and having a discussion on this with one of his professors, and said, you know, when they talk about wine in the New Testament, you know, are they really referring? Because it was common in the church, if you go back 40 years, to say, well, they talked about wine, but it really was just grape juice.
Yeah.
And he raised that issue. He said, you know, when they talk about wine in the New Testament, is it always fermented? He said the professor looked at him and said, why would they drink anything else? Yeah. Why would you just want to drink straight grape juice? You know, you want to drink the wine. Anyway, I'm sorry, we're getting sort of far afield here.
I think it's worth mentioning just a little bit that we've seen this discussion not too long ago, right, when we went into 2 Kings chapter 5. And there's the story of Naaman, who comes to see mm-hmm. Elijah.
Yeah.
And after he's converted, he makes a point to mention that there's going to be times when he goes back, right?
Yep.
That he's going to be required to partake of the food of the sacrifices that the king makes to his gods. He wants to make sure that that's okay. So there is this dialogue that's going on at this time and later as to how okay is this. And the book of Daniel takes a very stringent position on it that may well be related more to the later problems that Mike points out under the Greek dominance of that part of the world.
And it has to be said that one of the remarkable things about Judaism is that it survived. The fact that there is a Jewish people, after all the things they've gone through, it was these kinds of codes, among other things, that sort of kept them as a cohesive unit. So that even though they were scattered around Eastern Europe, and there were pogroms and the Holocaust and everything else, and all the temptations to fade in among or to mingle with the Gentiles around them, they didn't do it. I mean, I've actually heard people say that one of their favorite arguments for the existence of God is that the state of Israel exists. I mean, because Babylonia is gone, it will not come back. Assyria is gone, it's never going to come back. The Seleucids and so on, they're all gone. The Romans are gone. They'll never come back. Little tiny Israel, the Hebrews, still survive as a social unit. They today are speaking Hebrew more or less the way they spoke it back in antiquity. And it's partly these rules, these odd little rules that they had to negotiate how you live in a society that isn't Jewish dominated, where you're constantly interacting with non-Jews. How do you do that without losing your identity? And, they did it. They managed to do it. In fact, some would say in some ways that they did it all too well. It made them a target in Europe and so on, because they were so cliquish in a way, so segregated from the rest of the society around them. But the alternative was to disappear, as so many groups have done.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that the Latter-day Saints, we connect with that idea very, very well because of the persecution that we went through, not only in New York and in Ohio and Missouri and in Illinois, but also in Utah, where we established a strong community relationship that was largely based around plural marriage. And then what do we do when we have to change that? The word wisdom became in part something around which we could rally. This sets us apart as it makes us different.
Yeah. And it reminds you every time you sit down to eat, every time you go to a business lunch or you go out with non-Mormon friends and they order coffee or they order wine or something like that, you're reminded that you're not one of them. That's yeah. not meant to be a negative thing, but it reminds you of who you are.
Yeah.
And frankly, even something about the way we dress reminds you on a regular basis in the most practical daily sorts of ways that you're set apart in some way, and you should remember that. That's crucial, that boundary maintenance. It's not something to just slough off, because you look at certain other churches, the RLDS, for example, the Community of Christ, I think they've lost their identity to a certain extent. They've become a form of Protestantism because they don't have those clear boundary markers, that isolation of the Great Basin, the word of wisdom, certain modes of dress and so on are created for us.
And Dan, you appreciate this more than anyone. It's about the only thing that rivals some of the extremism of anti-Semitism is, of course, anti-Mormonism.
Mm-hmm.
I always find it fascinating whenever I see a mainstream or non-LDS originated post that mentions the church anywhere on the internet within minutes.
Yeah.
There are negative, hateful comments. People just feel that they have to jump in and immediately try to discredit the church, attack the church, mischaracterize it. You know, it's like, guys, get a life. It's not like I spend my time going around on websites that talk about, you know, Protestants or Catholics or Jews or Buddhists and say, no, Buddhism is really evil. They believe in all these different hells. You know, it's like, guys, get a grip. You know, I'm an ex, as I said in the comment to one of your posts, Dan, I'm an ex-Episcopalian. I have never felt any desire to attack the Episcopal Church.
Yeah.
You know, my mom's a member. I love her. I've attended church with her. I think they're good people. You know, I may disagree with them on doctrinal points, but, you know, I have no incentive to go back. It's like, get a grip. Anyway.
Yeah.
But that you know, that actually, that's a good point to bring up, just because we do have the same issue. And I don't think anyone's going to fully accept us. So we have to, you know, say, how are we going to live in a world that may like us from time to time, but that, you know, is willing to sort of mock us and turn on us quickly.
Yeah, the danger of assimilation is always there. And right now, I know it's a big worry for a lot of Jews. The many Jews are marrying outside of Judaism, and so the kids, the grandkids, grow up not even knowing. They may vaguely recall there was a Jewish ancestor back there somewhere, but I'll tell you, if you keep kosher, you're not likely to assimilate.
Yeah.
It has that function. It's just very difficult to assimilate if you keep those rules. So
we are about 40 minutes into this, and we're just Daniel chapter one. So maybe we should go on to chapter three.
Yeah, let's move on. Well, I think a lot of this has been establishing a context. So, you know, chapter three. Who wants to give us a summary of chapter three? Mike, you're up. There you go. Tell us about chapter three.
Daniel is not in chapter three. The people in chapter three are his three friends who have been given Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Their Hebrew names are mentioned early on in chapter one. And again, the historicity is an issue here because we just get to the end of chapter two where Daniel has interpreted the king's dream and he's raised to a great position of power and everything is going really well. And the next thing you know, he turns around and the king makes this gigantic 90-foot statue, and just because Daniel and his friends won't worship it, he's gonna have them tossed into this fire. So it does seem a little odd that he turns around so quickly on this. Of course, a very well-known, famous story. They stoke the furnace, seven times its normal temperature. It's so hot that the guards who throw the men into the fire, they die in the line of duty. And then Nebuchadnezzar is confused. He orders three men thrown into the fire, but then he reports, and this is verses 24 and 25, he reports seeing four men walking about unharmed. And I do want to take a minute here and point out, in an earlier email conversation we had in preparing for this, I referred to this as one of the most egregiously bad translations in the entire King James. The King James has got some bad translations, but Daniel chapter 3, verse 25 is really, really horrible. And unfortunately, it's led to a lot of misunderstanding about what's going on here. The King James says, according to Nebuchadnezzar, "Lo, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God," capital S, capital G. So the King James translators would have us believe that a polytheistic Babylonian who lived 600 years before Christ would explain what he saw in the fiery furnace from a New Testament Christian perspective. It simply doesn't work. The problem here is that the original language, and this is Aramaic in this passage, this is one of two small passages in the Old Testament that are not Hebrew, they're written in Aramaic, actually should read, and this is from the English Standard Version, But I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. And that makes a lot more sense from the context of a Babylonian. In other words, you look into the fire, you see a divine being, and so you think that it is a son of the Babylonian pantheon of gods who has come down, or a divine messenger. This is really, really common in the ancient world, is that you've got these divine beings, and you have these almost lesser divinities who are perhaps even the half-mortal and so forth will come down. And you see a lot of this in Greek mythology, where you've got Hercules, whose mother is human and whose father is Zeus and so forth. And this makes a lot more sense. So what we have here is a divine being. Unfortunately, the King James has given us the misreading here that it's actually Jesus Christ who's in the fire. There's even a painting that shows up, I believe it's in the Gospel Art Kit, of Jesus Christ standing in the fire with these three men, and that's not what the text says at all. It was Jesus Christ? Okay, maybe. It doesn't say that, though. What we do know is that there's a divine being who's there who has protected the three young men, and the result of the story is that because of this, they're brought out of the fire and restored to their positions of authority and so forth. They don't even smell like smoke when they come out.
Mm-hmm. One of the things the Hebrew Study Bible points out is that this chapter has these lists of names and lists of instruments that it keeps repeating over and over again in almost a comical effect. That this is a story meant to be read aloud. And, you know, you talk about all these officers, and it's when you hear the harp and the viol and the lyre and the psaltery and all types, and they go through that list.
The sackbut. The sackbut. Don't forget the sackbut. That's my favorite.
That's not in the translation here, but yeah. Anyway, but, you know, again, you have the lesson of obedience, but if you go back to the Book of Mormon, what you have is Alma and Amulek being, you know, forced to watch as women and children are actually thrown into a fiery pit and die. They are, you know, Amulek says, can't we stretch forth our hand and save them? And Alma says, no, we're forbidden. And they spend time in prison and are ultimately released in a miraculous way with the prison collapsing and so on. But, you know, that's probably a better story. You know, if someone chooses to throw you into a fiery pit, you're probably going to burn up. If they tie you up and put you into prison, there's always a chance that, you know, you may actually be freed by a divine intervention via earthquake. But, the story makes for a great story, but this is like a kid's bedtime story. You know, meant to be recited aloud with the lists and everything else, and you know, the irony of the guards being killed, but there's not even a smell of smoke or singeing on the three Nephites, the three Hebrews. Anyway, chapter 6. Since we're trying to get through this, I'd like to talk to you about chapter 6.
Oh, yeah, supposed to be chapter 5 as well.
We do actually, that's right. 5 is sort of alternate extra teaching, but yeah.
Well, we can...
Let's talk about it.
I can mention them both briefly. Chapter 5, of course, deals with the story of the writing on the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
The writing mysteriously appears on the wall, and the king has no idea what it says, and he calls all of his wise men together, and they can't tell him what it means, and so the queen, and here we have little overtones of Esther, right, where the queen gets involved and points out that there's this Hebrew that may be able to help the king, and so they call Daniel in, and Daniel reads the writing on the wall, and says to the king, "You're days are numbered. God is going to give your kingdom away to somebody else. And the other interesting thing, of course, is that Daniel tells the king he doesn't want to receive payment for it, right? That night the king gets killed and the kingdom transfers to the Persians. The surprising part of this is the king isn't given any chance, right, to repent, to change his ways, to somehow avert the destruction that's going to come. This is just to point out to everybody that the king is done for, and Daniel knows it already, right?
This writing on the wall, by the way, it's not just here that it shows up. It's also Exodus chapter 31 has a similar event, Alma chapter 10, and Ether chapter 3. It seems to be kind of a popular way of God communicating from time to time, is just to write stuff on walls.
I actually heard a story of someone that it happened to many, many years ago. He was an old man then, so it probably happened in the early 1900s. A patriarch who gave his first patriarchal blessing. He was terrified. He'd never received one himself. There were no manuals, no instructions. He had written one out for this kid. He thought at first, you know, wow, I'm going to have the honor, but nobody will ever ask me. It was a long time until some kid asked for a blessing, and he wrote one out and memorized it because he was so terrified. And then he said, in my hearing, that he put his hands on the kid's head. When he began to give the blessing, he felt that he should open his eyes, and there on the wall was a blessing that it would appear line by line. He read it off. It was utterly unlike what he'd prepared, and he said it never happened again, but it didn't have to. I wasn't worried after that. So, you know, take it for what it's worth. But there may be a modern parallel to these stories, too.
Yep.
Well, and of course, nowadays we often hear of the appearances of the Virgin, right?
Mm-hmm.
In tree stumps, in loaves of bread. No, that's something else.
Toast.
You know, perhaps this is an easy way for them to visualize it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We kind of get this sense, too, in the beginning of the Book of Mormon in the Liahona, the writing that appears there. I think that this was maybe a way that they expected it. And you know, we kind of see a little bit of this, too, perhaps, in the translation of the Book of Mormon, right?
Yeah.
Depending on which account we look at, where Joseph is reading, reading the translation. Anyway, moving on to chapter 6. Chapter 6 is the other story that we're all real familiar with, the lion's den. We get the laws made. The king is tricked into making a law that will get rid of Daniel, who has risen to some notoriety, right, in a position of power, and in a power play, they find a way to trick the king into condemning Daniel. Daniel goes into the lion's den and plays frisbee with the kitties.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes out, the king realizes that he's made a terrible mistake, and the accusers end up...
with their families.
And their families, yeah.
The whole thing. Yeah. The lions ate well that night, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One little touch that you see in these stories is that we may think, oh, how nice, the righteous man was vindicated, but wow, the upshot is often pretty brutal by our standards. Not only does the bad guy get it, but his whole family, his wife and his children and everything else. The stories are a little less healing to us today, I suspect, if we read them all the way.
There's real object lessons here, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just that you should do the right thing and you'll be blessed. It's a reminder that if you don't do the right thing, right, you have no expectation of being saved, and every expectation of bad things happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
And at that actually... go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that's actually a good lead into Esther, because that's pretty much the whole underlying theme of Esther.
Yeah,
the attempt to wipe out the Jews and how that turns back upon the heads of the enemies of the Jews.
May I just mention something here? One note that you see in this story, in chapter 6 of Daniel, and then you see it in the story of Haman and his scheme against the Jews, is in both cases you have a basically benign king who is misled by an advisor who tricks him into signing something that he doesn't really know, doesn't understand the implications of, and then he really can't get out of it, or, well, in Esther he does. It occurs to me that, and it just occurred to me now, I don't know if this is really true or not, it's just speculation, that one thing this might be doing for Jews of a later period would be to allow them to maintain some sort of nominal or titular loyalty to the monarch by explaining that, well, whatever bad things are happening to us right now, it's not because the king wants to do it. It's because he's been misled by evil advisors. It's their fault. So it doesn't put them in a position of actually resisting the king, the monarch. He's a good guy. He's been misled. It's his advisors who've plotted this against us. It allows you to maintain a non-seditious relationship with the king, which would be helpful for survival, I would think. Like the people in Stalin's Russia used to say when they're awaiting execution in the gulag, well, if Comrade Stalin only knew about this, he would surely stop it. He just must not know.
So. Well, these types of issues, we don't just see them in Daniel and Esther, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's an entire genre of literature from that period. We see it mostly what's left now in Egyptian texts. But we see these same kind of themes and stories, which is part of the reason why we understand that they fit a certain historical model of writing. As well as including, you know, these other things for us.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to Esther?
Yeah, I think the theme of six ties us into Esther, because that's just a longer, in some respects, a longer and more elaborated version of what we have in Daniel 6.
Yeah.
Except that the hero is a woman.
Yeah. That's nice.
Yep. This is actually one of my daughters, Crystal. This was always her favorite Bible story. Mm. It was the story of Esther. Anyway, so who'd like to summarize Esther for us? Dan?
Well, very quickly. Yeah, Esther's the story of a woman, a Jewish woman, young woman, who is taken as a wife by the king, Ahasuerus, which is Xerxes, Persian king, king of Persia and Media, and because his first king, Vashti, had disobeyed him. I mean, in this way, it's sort of like, I suppose, the Taming of the Shrew or something. There's a wife who didn't obey, and one of the underlying themes here, repeated several times, is Vashti's a threat, because, boy, if other women start seeing that Vashti can disobey the king this way, husbands will be disrespected all throughout the realm, and we can't permit that. So she's deposed, and then there's a competition. Before we got on, somebody was talking about this. Who was it? Was it Ben?
Yeah, that was me.
Kind of like, you know, well, what was the symbol you used?
Let's just back up a little bit. This is really the form of this whole book is a novel.
Yeah.
And it's not just any novel. It's a romantic novel.
Mm-hmm.
And these elements that we don't necessarily see as romantic today, but they did back then, are all there. We have these feasts, the parties, right, that last for days and days. The centerpiece at the beginning here, right, is they gather all these virgins together to find the new wife for the king. And this event lasts more than a year.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to put this into a modern depiction, make a modern movie out of it, right, it would be just like reality TV, The Bachelor. Here's the king. He's the bachelor. We're going to line up all these women, let them take all this time to pamper and prepare themselves, and now they get to go on little dates with the king. That's a contest, right?
Yeah.
This is a glorified contest to see who can catch the eye of the king and win his approval. Who can be obedient, right? I mean, there's going to be that little bit in there. Who can be the queen that the king needs, that, as opposed to the queen that he didn't. So this is really fun to read. And I don't think we mentioned this at the beginning, but in all of Esther, God is never mentioned.
Yeah.
This is not really a spiritual religious text, although when they translated into Greek, they added God in everywhere, perhaps even overcompensating a little bit. Yeah. And since our scriptures to some extent were influenced by the Greek texts, this is one of the reasons why it later became a part of scripture, I think, for us today. is because of that, that spiritual reading. And it, the spiritual reading doesn't just show up in the Greek text, right? This, the Greek text relied on by Josephus and some of the other later Jewish historians. But the Jews had mixed feelings about the text of this book. For example, with the Dead Sea Scrolls, they didn't find a single copy.
Yeah.
Which meant at least that group didn't have any high opinion of it at all. So anyway, let's jump back to the story.
Well, but it's not just that God isn't mentioned, but it doesn't mention anything like prayer, the law, temple, sacrifice, covenants, you know, themes that are just almost universal throughout the Old Testament. It's completely silent. The only issue that comes up is fasting, and it's mentioned twice in passing.
Yeah. It's a very nationalistic book. It's about Jewish nationalism in a way, the survival of and triumph of the Jewish people. But it is not an exceptionally spiritual book. And so even today in Israel, for example, where Purim, the festival of lots, is celebrated, it's celebrated as kind of a joke. It's a time to get smashed and play party games. And it's not a solemn religious holiday. This isn't simply because so many Jews are secular. They're very solemn about Yom Kippur and Passover and so on for the most part. But Purim is just fun. They don't take it too seriously as a religious holiday. No. There are several things about the book that are just difficult to square historically. For example, if Mordecai really came out of Jerusalem when Jerusalem fell, and he's still alive in the days of Xerxes, he is really, really old. Really old. I mean, this is long past the days of the long, long, long lifetimes.
Older than you, Dan?
No, but you know, I mean, I'm sort of unique in that. But most other people don't make it as old as I do. No, but you're long past the period of the long Genesis lifespans, and it doesn't make anything of a miraculous lifespan for him. It just mentions some dates, and they make it very difficult to believe this guy really came out of Jerusalem as a captive in the initial days of the captivity and is still there and still active in the days of Xerxes, Ahasuerus. Am I still doing the summary? I'll just do it.
Sure.
Anybody can pitch in at any point. Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, marries Esther, whose name is also Hadassah in Hebrew. The big medical system in Israel today is called the Hadassah Medical System, Hadassah Hospital, named after her. Then there's a plot against the king, and Mordecai, her relative, puts an end to that plot, but he's not rewarded properly. That'll come up later. But Mordecai, for reasons that are not clearly explained, doesn't show proper deference to a new rising star in the administration there in Persia, and that's Haman. And Haman is a guy who's not only ambitious, but he is very prickly. I mean, he wants respect. He demands it. And now, Mordecai is not... Oh, go ahead.
We should mention that it says that Haman is an Agagite.
Yeah.
And Agag was the king of the Amalekites that were, for the most part, completely demolished by David and Saul as part of the establishment of Jerusalem and the kingdom years and years earlier. He's the perfect villain to contest the place of the Hebrews.
He comes from a line where you'd expect him to be a bad guy. And so Mordecai fails to defer to him. Haman wants revenge, but he wants revenge on a large scale, not merely against Mordecai. He's going to kill all the Jews, maybe because he's an Agagite, you know, maybe the hereditary enmity or something like that. Eventually, of course, Esther is prevailed upon to intervene. The plot is thwarted. Haman is hanged upon the gallows he prepared for Mordecai. The Jews triumph by butchering everybody in the kingdom who was going to be involved in the plot against them. Again, it's that kind of overdone, from our perspective, overdone vengeance. Not only Haman is killed, but Haman's 10 sons, they all are killed.
And 75,000 Persians as well, who did nothing at all other than just hate Jews. I mean, it's like open season. We're gonna just wipe them all out and then throw a big party.
Yeah. So it, in some ways, it's kind of an unappealing, unappetizing holiday and story. But what you get again here is the idea of the faithful Esther, who is placed in this position. I think one of the crucial lines is that Mordecai persuades her to intervene and says, "Who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" The idea is there's providence in this, even though God isn't mentioned. That in some way providence is involved. She's placed in this position where she can save her people. That's why she's there. And then she heroically goes forward because it's death to appear before the king if the king doesn't want you there, to appear uninvited in his presence. And she says, well, if I perish, I perish, but I have to do this for my people, basically. So, yeah.
Though actually, even tempering that a bit, Mordecai says, don't think that you're going to escape this.
Yeah, right.
Just because you're married to the king. So it's again, you know, it's a wonderful story. And so Mordecai is saying, you know, you're going to get this just as much. The underlying theme seems to just anticipate and may be generated as per earlier comments by the ongoing problems of coexistence and assimilation that Jews were facing. Mm-hmm. By the second century BC, and the sad thing is it pretty much presages what they're going to be going through for the next 2,200 years.
Oh yeah,
where people make repeated attempts to either you know, control them in ghettos or wipe them out altogether, and certainly they will be blamed time and time again, and face pogroms and. Various other forms of persecution. So it's the historical issues aside regarding the story itself, it certainly established a pattern that the Jews have become all too familiar with for two millennia.
The astonishing thing is that anti-Semitism is on the rise again in Europe. I mean, it's hard to believe that just a few decades after the fall of the Third Reich, now we've got it again, and of course anti-Semitism of this peculiar kind, anti-Jewish sentiment, is very much alive in the Middle East, alas. So for some reason, the Jews have faced this through much of their history.
What they haven't faced, or what they by and large haven't been able to do, is what happens in Esther, which is where they rise up and kill their enemies.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, without getting into all the issues between Israel and the Palestinians, basically any effort to in fact defend themselves, they then have to face additional criticism.
Yeah. You
know, like whether or not their efforts are actually proportionate or justifiable or whatever, they lose both ways.
Right. Yeah, it's not a good history. In that sense. So difficult for them. So this book, I suppose, is still inspirational in its way to many Jews.
It's a very interesting book because there's kind of two. You can look at it from a couple of different perspectives, and the positive one is that first of all there's precious few stories about women mm-hmm. in the scriptures, particularly women who have names. Right. And here we have an entire book that is just completely dedicated to a woman who is a woman not only of great beauty, but also of great moral courage. Mm-hmm. And she uses her wisdom and her insight to protect her people
and her
from
beauty.
Destruction and, and her beauty. Well, and that's kind of the opposite end of it is that you could read this, and perhaps I'm being kind of cynical here, but you could read this as that the moral of the story is if you're hot, keep yourself looking hot because you never know when you're going to be able to use sex to influence people who are powerful.
That's a really good point for a gospel doctrine class.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and this is why I'm rather conflicted about the Book of Esther, because while there are some very good moral principles in there about, you know, listening to this wise older counselor and going forth and saving people and so forth, you know, that the basic setup here is exactly what Ben was talking about, is that, you know, the king just basically sleeps his way through the entire kingdom. You know, it's really tough being king. I tell you, the burdens of administration are just really hard. You know, but why does she get picked? She initially gets picked not because she's wise or because she's got great, you know, courage and so forth. She's picked because she's good looking. Yeah. Now, it just so happens that the Lord is able to use somebody in the right position. The text doesn't say that, but the underlying principle is that. But, yeah, you can overread it, I think. And so you do have to be careful if you're bringing this into a young women's third hour meeting to say, let's talk about Esther. Let's talk about the good parts of Esther and not necessarily.
Is she a role model for Mormon young women? Exactly. Yeah, the story of the king with all these dates, whatever you want to call them euphemistically, it is reminiscent of another much later frame story, which is the 1001 Nights of Scheherazade, you know, putting an end to the king's practice of taking a new wife every night and then killing her the following morning, because his first wife was not disobedient but unfaithful. Yeah. It's a recurring kind of story in the Middle East.
Or even Cinderella. I mean, these are this concept is the same, where the king is going around trying to find somebody, and you know, it's very common among many cultures to have this type of story.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we've probably thoroughly depressed any gospel doctrine teachers who are listening to the roundtable. We'll probably go back and say, okay, let's talk about these Bible stories. What do they mean? But the point is that, you know, these are, first, I think it's important if you're teaching the Old Testament to have at least a good comprehension of the strengths and weaknesses of the Old Testament. And once you get past that, say, you know, these are some good stories. They're inspirational. They form, you know, they at least on a certain level have patterns. But Dan, I actually invoked your name in our gospel doctrine class last Sunday. They were teaching one of the lessons in Isaiah, and it may have been one that we did here. It's a number of brief passages referring to Christ, and the teacher, who's a really good teacher, said, you know, I actually was looking at some different translations, and I'm not sure these passages mean exactly what they mean. You know, and I'm a bit conflicted because this is what the Gospel Doctrine Manual is saying they mean. And I raised my hand and said, well, I have a good friend, Dan Peterson, who for many years helped put these manuals together. And I don't know if I should have said this in class. He's basically the first to tell you, no, these are not revealed manuals.
They are definitely not.
I said, so, you know, if you've got issues there, you know, don't feel that you're somehow apostatizing because the lesson manual is trying to put an interpretation on a passage that you don't find is actually supported when you dig into it, which is pretty much what we've been talking about all evening here.
That's true.
Go ahead.
I have just one final thought, I think, or at least for me, for this lesson that kind of goes along with it. We've been talking a little about history and the value of these stories. But so one thing that I was reminded of as I was preparing my notes for tonight, there's a book that we're all more familiar with, the shows that come of it, called Phantom of the Opera. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of it, the narrator gives a little bit of an introduction. And I'm going to read a paragraph from it. He says, "Lastly, with my bundle of papers in hand, I once more went over the ghost's vast domain, the huge building which he had made his kingdom. All that my eyes saw, all that my mind perceived, corroborated the Persian's documents precisely, and a wonderful discovery crowned my labors in a very definite fashion. It will be remembered that later, when digging in the substructure of the opera before burying the phonographic records of the artist's voice, the workmen laid bare a corpse. While I was at once able to prove that this corpse was that of the opera ghost, I made the acting manager put this proof to the test with his own hand, and it is now a matter of supreme indifference to me if the papers pretend that the body was that of a victim of the commune."
Hmm.
And we have this work of fiction, and yet, in 2007, they uncovered the time capsule containing the photographic records mentioned in this book in the introduction. These records that had been preserved for 100 years in one of the many subfloors underneath the opera house. So we talk about this stuff, and yet it's very easy for us to recognize that there may be elements in these stories of real histories and real people behind them, even if even if we don't understand how to connect the stories that we read to the potential real people behind them.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Excellent point.
Well, and the problem that we find in today's world is that there are people who want to take, for example, the Book of Mormon and move it and say it's not historical, it's inspiring, but inspired fiction and so forth. The problem is that Esther and Jonah do not appear as resurrected beings right. to the prophet Joseph Smith. There's a big difference there.
Yep, and it is an important difference. And the reason why I think the stories as they stand are worth repeating and worth teaching is because we have parallel stories in the Book of Mormon that, you know, from my point of view, are you know, much more greatly historically attested. You have the same sort of courage. You have the same sort of, you know, facing opposition at the risk of your life, in some cases at the cost of your life. And at the same time, you also have the stories of those who, because of their courage and example, changed the course of history. That occurs several times in the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
With all the historical problems, you know, that we've cited, these are still great stories, and there's still stories you can tell your kids, and there's still stories we can draw examples from, because we know of equivalent stories that we can document much better historically. Mm-hmm. You know, right down to Joseph F. Smith's famous, you know, being confronted by a drunken horseman saying, "Are you one of those blankety-blank Mormons?" and saying, "Yes, sir, you know, dyed in the wool, true blue, and, you know, well, let me shake your hand. You're the blankety-blank friendliest person I ever met." That's one of the important lessons for us, is that we do need to actually not be ashamed of who we are as individuals and as a people, and continue to stand for our standards in the face of opposition, and in some cases, particularly, you know, Dan, outright hatred, foaming at the mouth type hatred.
I'll pass on something that was related to me last night by someone who had just had a long conversation with a close relative who is a senior member of the Quorum of the Twelve, who is concerned about what's going to happen, as he sees it, if religious persecution and intolerance rises. He says, what's going to happen to the members of the church who are not that strong when people begin writing graffiti on their doors, or when there's, you know, there's opposition, hostility to at their places of business and so on? He says, those days are probably going to come, and then what will they do? Well, these stories are examples of courage, what you do. We're not done with that kind of thing necessarily. We're basking in kind of a pleasant time, maybe not as great as it was in the 50s or the 60s, but you know, we're not facing violent persecution or anything like that. But you know, some things could be coming. These things go in cycles. And if you're not well grounded, then you won't make it. These stories here of people who are, you know, however historically true they may be or may not be, they're about people who are well-grounded, who don't bend, who don't back down, who ultimately triumph because they're faithful.
And as per your comments, the history of the Jews is the history of a people who have managed to preserve their identity for 3,000 years in spite of constant opposition.
Yeah.
Anyway, any last comments? Ben, Mike, Dan? If not, we hope you've enjoyed this. I hope this has been useful for you. Again, Dan Peterson, Ben McGuire, Mike Parker, I'm Bruce Webster, and we hope you'll come back next week for the next roundtable.